Good day and welcome to Letters on Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. This is a quote. All religions are equally sublime to the ignorant, useful to the politician, and ridiculous to the philosopher. That is from the ancient Roman poet Lucretius and his monumental work that can still be found in bookstores today called On the Nature of Things. It's from this about 2,000 years ago where we get a philosophy about the universe that is not controlled by gods but by the laws of nature and of matter coming together and coming apart. Today we're going to be in conversation about this work and how it has been handed down through the ages. Our guest is Stephen Greenblatt. In 2012, Stephen Greenblatt won the Pulitzer Prize for his book, The Swerve, How the World Became Modern. Stephen Greenblatt, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you to this radio station.
Thanks, Mitch. Great to be here.
Let's begin with, who was Lucretius?
Well, we don't know. We wish you knew a lot more about him. We know a very, very little bit. Lucretius was born around 99 before the Common Era. He died around 50 before the Common Era. He was a contemporary, that means, of Julius Caesar or Cicero, Ovid. He was an older contemporary of Virgil. So he was known. People admired him at the time extravagantly. At least the small number of people whose traces we have speak well of him. But otherwise, we don't know very much about him. We know a huge amount about Ovid's sex life. We know a lot about Virgil's political life and so forth. About this man, Titus Lucretius Carus, we know really almost nothing. We know that he says about himself that he's a passionate follower of the Greek philosopher Epicurus, who lived several hundred years before his own time. And so he's a kind of disciple in that sense. But the only thing we know biographically about Lucretius, besides the very rough information I've just given you, comes from much later. In the 4th century, the Christian father of the church, St. Jerome, wrote a few comments in an old chronicle, updating a chronicle, and he said that Titus Lucretius Carus was born at a certain point that I told you, and that he had been given a love potion by his wife, and he went mad as a result of the love potion, and in the intervals of his madness, he wrote this poem before he committed suicide. And that is endlessly recycled, that information in biographies of Lucretius. Maybe it's true, but it's the kind of thing that Christian fathers of a distinguished kind, like St. Jerome, thought probably would have happened to pagan philosophers. That's the kind of thing that they deserved, as it were. Right. That's the kind of thing that happened to you. So it comes from several hundred years later. I myself am exceedingly skeptical that we should believe those details.
Well, it's fascinating because his work on the nature of things and quite honestly, after going through your book, I downloaded the audio version on my iPad on the nature of things. And it's remarkable of how modern it sounds.
It's eerie for us. And that was very much my first impression. And in a deep way, it's my last impression as well. There's a lot of ways in which, of course, it's not modern. It was written several thousand years ago. Its account of the world is not our account of the world and lots of its details. But at its core, it has a set of ideas that, at least for me, when I first encountered this poem when I was a very young man, just took my breath away, and they still take my breath away. It starts with the idea that the universe is just made up out of atoms, an innumerable number, an infinite number of invisible, indestructible pieces of matter. And that's it. Atoms and emptiness and nothing else. What does that mean? No mysterious demons, no mysterious other forces moving things around. And then it starts to draw conclusions from this very, very simple starting point of atoms and emptiness and nothing else. And the conclusions, one after the other, are amazing, starting with the idea that if matter is eternal, if it's been banging together these atoms for years, forever, then it doesn't need a creator. And it doesn't need a designer, so that there's no intelligent design. There's no grand plan. There's only the infinite dance of matter in the universe. Some things coming together, coming apart, coming together, coming apart in different experimental forms over an eternity.
Nothing lasts forever, though the basic matter, the basic particles, does.
Nothing lasts forever except the atoms themselves, he thought. Yeah. But the forms of things don't last forever. On the contrary, he said that if this is the case, and he believed this to be the case, and the model for this is not experimental science. The model for this is just trying to think.
Yeah.
So the idea...
The telescopes, or not the telescopes, the microscopes,
yes.
They didn't have.
Let alone the electron microscope. What they had was the speculative mind of human beings over many, many centuries. And this starts basically from looking at a beam of sunlight and noticing that there are these very strange thousands and thousands of things dancing in the sunlight, not thinking that those are atoms because these people knew perfectly well they're way too big because they're visible to be atoms, but thinking, what if that's what the universe is? The universe is made up out of these tiny particles. And then thinking that if that's the case, that everything that is, the pyramids, the Earth itself, the inhabitants of the Earth, these are the results of over fantastic lengths of time, the accidents of things coming together and coming apart. And in the case of living things, what they thought was if a living species came about, again, purely accidental in its various features, and it could figure out how to get food and how to reproduce, then that species might last for a while. And then eventually would disappear when the environment changed, the world changed, and other species would come about. So it thought that, Lucretius thought that there probably were other forms of life on the Earth before we existed as humans. There would be other forms in life after we ceased to exist, that it wasn't all about humans. It was about a much more broad-based natural process that would never come to an end.
Also about life and death.
Well, about death only in the sense that this was the good news Lucretius was offering, that, as he put it, death is nothing to us. Death is nothing to us. What he meant by that is that the fantasies that the religions of his time had...
Which is before Christianity.
Before Christianity. We're talking about several generations before Christianity. The ideas that humans had that they could be rewarded and punished in an afterlife, that they might be rolling a rock up a mountain forever and having the rock roll down. They might be dying of terrible thirst, or they might be rewarded in the Elysian fields and dancing around with their friends and lovers, that these were all fantasies that would not be fulfilled, that the soul, and Lucretius very much thought we had souls, the souls were made up out of atoms, the way the body is made up out of. They thought the atoms were very tiny things, the atoms of the soul, and they would come apart. When the body comes apart, nothing would last forever. The soul wouldn't survive the body any more than the body would continue. So that the idea that you would go through an eternity of either punishment or reward seemed absurd to Lucretius. And he said, basically, that's the good news. The good news is that death is nothing to us. Of course, some people didn't think it was the good news. Cicero, Lucretius' contemporary, said basically, that's the good news, that I would rather believe that we had to push rocks up for an eternity.
For nothing.
rather than simply cease to be.
Was there a prevailing thought? Again, during his time, the final 100 years around there, the Roman Republic, the time of Cicero.
Yes.
What was the thought of life after death?
Well, I think there were a lot of different thoughts competing. He lived in a strange time in which disturbing things were happening in the Roman Republic. The different political parties, as it were, in the Roman Republic couldn't speak to each other or compromise any longer. The economy was going to hell. There were very deeply disturbing things in the military and in the on the borderlands. The Roman Republic was still extremely powerful, but there was handwriting on the wall that this was not going to go on forever. And what there is evidence of a lot of people basically asking themselves, what is this about? And there were lots of different explanations, different possible answers. One thing it might be about was to appease Jupiter, to appease Venus, to make the correct offerings to the gods. There were rumors of mystical religions in the East that would have solutions that either the Jews or strange fragments of the Jews would have solutions having to do with the Messiah that they talked about. And then there were lots of people who sat around saying, no, what if it was not about any of these things? What if it is about just the way nature is and what we have to do in the world if we're not going to have any divine forces either saving us or punishing us?
And you mentioned about the influence of Epicurus, the Greek philosopher.
Yes. One school of philosophy that was active in this time, the first century before the Common Era, was an older school, a school of Greek philosophy identified with Epicurus and before Epicurus with Epicurus' own masters, Democritus and Leucippus. Now, that Greek school was a school that started with the idea of atoms. Atoms is a Greek word, the thing that can't be broken apart, and tried to think about the conclusions of that. What's fascinating about that school is, of course, no pagan religious figure had a horse in that race because he didn't want to think that there are no gods who will intervene in the universe, or if that Epicurus thought they were gods, but he thought the gods would simply be lying around taking pleasure in existence. So the Greeks, the pagans didn't like this view, and then the Jews didn't like this view. The Hebrew word for atheist is apikoros, Epicurean. And then when the Christians came along, the Christians hated this view, of course, since it didn't allow room for for the transcendental force that Christians believed in. So no one with a religious viewpoint in life, a viewpoint that focused on the punishments and rewards that a god might give you, had a particular love for this theory.
So the root word, just to highlight this again, of atheist comes from the Hebrew word for Epicurus.
Well, the Hebrew word for atheist, apikoros, is an Epicurean. In other words, that is an Epicurean. As I say, Epicurus himself said, we thought the gods existed as Lucretius thought the gods existed, but they existed as models for what human beings should do. And what they thought human beings should do was what they said all living creatures naturally and instinctively do, which is try to pursue pleasure and avoid pain. But that view, pursuing pleasure and avoiding pain, was not consistent with a lot of other competing religious views and military views, for that matter, to pursue virtue, to pursue piety, to pursue honor, to pursue glory, to pursue wisdom. These are all alternatives to the idea of the pursuit of pleasure as the highest good and the avoidance of pain. But Epicurus and Lucretius thought anything that we do in life, any ethical account of the world, any attempt we have to make sense of the world has to begin and end with our creaturely desire for pleasure and our creaturely desire to avoid pain. And not just us, but they thought we're animals like other animals. Yeah. We do what other animals do, and we should do what other animals do in terms of enhancing pleasure and reducing pain.
Again, we are in conversation with Stephen Greenblatt. He is the author of the new book, The Swerve, How the World Became Modern. And of course, we haven't even gotten to the modern world. What's fascinating is how, in a way, history repeats itself. Because if you look at Lucretius during the first year before Common Era in the Roman Republic, the Roman Republic in itself was its own renaissance. Right? From the Greek, the ancient Greek, again, Epicurus.
The Romans were mad for all things Greek. They loved Greek statues, they loved Greek paintings, and they loved Greek philosophers, and they paid for them to come to Rome after Rome conquered Greece. They paid for their students to go and study in Greek schools and for their children, and they paid for Greek philosophers and other Greek scholars, along with artists and dancers and so forth, to come to Rome for them. In fact, one of the reasons that we know about this school at all, apart from this one great discovery that is what my book's about, the moment at which this is recovered for the world, but one reason we know about this is a strange thing happened, which is that in 79 of the Common Era, there was the massive eruption of Mount Vesuvius in the Bay of Naples. And the huge volcanic eruption, all the pumice and lava, buried two great cities in the Bay of Naples. Actually, not such great cities, but wonderful vacation spots, namely Pompeii and Herculaneum. And in Herculaneum, which was a kind of lovely, I don't know what, how fancy Bel Air or Sausalito, they found a... in the 18th century of our era, in the 18th century when they discovered there were some statues there, and they started digging through the volcanic tufa to find the statues. The people who were digging broke through to a space underground. They were way underground at that point. That must have, they understood, was an open-air space back in 79 of the Common Era. And they found what looked like a extremely convenient pile of charcoal briquettes. They took the briquettes up. It was cold. And they started to burn them. And it was only until one of the workmen dropped one of the briquettes and it broke open, they saw that there were letters inside, and they realized that they weren't charcoal briquettes at all. They were books, books in the form of scrolls, which the ancients used. And they began to try to figure out what was written in the scrolls. And then they discovered, when they did eventually decipher the scrolls, that the very fancy nobleman whose house they were in the first century of the Common Era, had a library that focused precisely on the school of philosophy that we're talking about today, Mitch, the school that said the world is made up out of atoms and emptiness and nothing else. And that was a breakthrough to trying to understand who read this thing in that world, who would have been lying around in the Bay of Naples on a couch having a slave presumably peeled some grapes for you,
right?
And then talk about the nature of the universe.
Well, then, just an interesting side note, you mentioned scrolls, and that's what we used to use 2,000, probably 1,000 years ago as well. So we used to scroll through paper and writing, and then we had bounded books. But once again, we're scrolling again
on
the computer.
The computer has brought back this term as a meaningful term. But once the book, in our normal form of books, called them codexes, codices, came back in, for most people, as indeed for me still, it seems like an incredibly good idea, because you can certainly in relation to the old-fashioned scrolls, if you've ever seen the scrolls that Jews still use in their services, they're incredibly difficult to find your way around, and you can't have an index, and the pages aren't numbered in a normal way. So it's a hell of an improvement to come up with these codices. And it was only until the computer, with its search functions and so forth, that you can actually get back to the idea of scrolling. The trouble with this, Mitch, is that those old scrolls, or for that matter, the old books which were written on parchment, could still be legible after 300, 400, 500 years. Or in the case of the things dug up from the ruins of Herculaneum, those fragments of the old scrolls can be read 2,000 years later. You can imagine how much our digital technology will be comprehensible to people after 500 years.
I mean,
after
if we're
years.
Still around, it would be fascinating
this
to think
about. This stuff is almost impossible to figure out what it is.
Yeah. And it'll be fascinating what future historians and the breadth of knowledge that they'll have about us.
Well, if we ever get unplugged, Mitch, that people are going to have a hell of a time
figuring out
what
it
was
lost.
That we wrote.
Yeah.
Because we're simply not going to be comprehensible. Even without being unplugged, our digital platforms change every few years. We have traded, in effect, durability, long-term durability, for access. We have access of a kind that would have been inconceivable to the ancient world. We have fantastic access through our computer technologies. What we don't have is durability. We're counting on the fact that our system is going to carry on and will be able to jump from one platform to another. But as anyone who used, as I did, a K-Pro, for example, when I was starting out using computer, I can't read any of the stuff that I wrote then on those floppy disks. I mean, maybe someone in NASA could figure out what the hell I wrote, but it's impossible for me.
And that's interesting, because even when you look at the classical world, and we almost lost this poem on the nature of things by Lucretius.
Not only do we almost lose that,
we've lost most things.
Did effectively lose most things, number one. There was a great vanishing. And the vanishing happened at the end of the Roman Empire, when the barbarians were at the gates or broke through the gates, when people were hauled off into slavery, when the towns were sacked, when people started to lock the libraries and never go back to them, when villas were burned down, libraries were shut, with the educational system was basically shut down. The whole program of copying texts year after year to keep them going ceased to be. And in this case, for more than 1,000 years, this text dropped out of circulation. But not only this text of Lucretius, this amazing poem, but the entire school of philosophy dropped out of circulation. And most of that school of philosophy has never come back.
We have just a little portion of it.
Almost nothing. All of Democritus is gone except for a few quotations. All of Leucippus is gone except for a few quotations. Virtually all of the voluminous works of Epicurus are gone, except for three letters which are quoted in an ancient historian of philosophy and a few maxims, and everything depended on the very, very slender thread of the survival of this poem, of which there were, well, no copies that had been effectively seen for a millennium. It turned out that there was a surviving copy. There are two or three surviving copies, we now know, but there was a surviving copy, and one day in January 1417, someone found that copy.
That somebody was Poggio.
That someone was a bureaucrat named Poggio Bracciolini, was a papal bureaucrat, a poor guy by birth, from a very, very modest background, who had made it into the job, the equivalent of the Goldman Sachs job from the 1980s that ambitious young men or women wanted. This was a job working in the Vatican, which he got in the 1390s. And in his spare time, he had a fascination with dredging up the traces of the ancient world. And he had a chance in the early years of the 15th century to pursue this passion, a chance for crazy reasons that happened to him. And he had the good fortune of finding this amazing lost poem.
I mean, he wasn't the only one at the time looking for books. I mean, this is where we really start to begin sort of a modern sense of book hunters.
There were a group of people. They had been fired up by a man named, remarkable scholar and poet named Francesco Petrarca, Petrarch we call him, in the 14th century, and who made himself famous, among other things, for finding lost works by Cicero, lost works by the poet Propertius and others, the lost history by Livy. And people got excited for the first time in a larger group of people. There are probably always a few eccentric people who are interested in this kind of thing, but people got excited for the first time with the possibility of a major effort to look. Because Italians, of course, have always been surrounded by the traces of a vanished world. You could just look around, as you can now in Rome, Florence, anywhere else, and see it. But they had done for centuries what, for a long time afterwards, the Italians had always done. They basically used those physical traces as a kind of quarry to build whatever they wanted to build now. So most of the great churches of the Middle Ages and the Renaissance in Italy are made up out of marbles and precious stones ripped out of the old pagan temples.
Right.
And what happened basically in the 15th century is that people began to think, what if we could find books? What if we could find manuscripts that would bring back that not only the physical world that we see all around us, but the mental world of that lost civilization.
And that brings us the Renaissance.
And that brings us this very strange cultural moment, which we call the Renaissance, a rebirth not only of classical styles. That's why the banks and libraries and so forth look the way they look in our world, with very frequently with columns and so forth on them. But more importantly, they brought back a set of ideas that had basically fallen away for centuries. And they came back, in the case of this work, Lucretius's On the Nature of Things, they came back in the weirdest form, in the sense that the ancient philosophies, the philosophy of Plato, the philosophy of Aristotle, pieces of that had survived through the Middle Ages and had been accommodated to Christianity. Christian philosophers depended in a very deep way on Plato and even more on Aristotle to make sense
of the world.
St. Thomas Aquinas.
Yeah.
But this philosophy, the philosophy of Epicurus, the one that said there were atoms and emptiness and nothing else, this was not so easily accommodated. This was weird. It was as if a flying saucer had come down at that point after 1,000 years from Mars and said, this is the way the world is. Atoms and emptiness and nothing else. No providence, no intelligent design, no gods to appease, no fear of death, no dream of reward, just this. And you can imagine what that was like in the 15th century when it came back.
So how was it treated? I mean, you write about the influence that this particular piece on the nature of things by Lucretius had on the Renaissance.
Ultimately, this huge influence, at least I think, this is a debatable point, ultimately this huge influence, but it's the influence a little bit like the butterfly effect in chaos theory, where there is some movement that ultimately leads to a huge thing, a hurricane, a typhoon, but it doesn't happen immediately. As you might imagine, Mitch, when this stuff comes back, when the flying saucer lands and this philosophy comes out speaking its words, people either scratch their heads saying this is insane, or they said this is wicked, or they said both.
Yeah.
A very small number of people, tiny number of people in those early decades after it came back, thought, there's something interesting going on here. The most brilliant philosopher of the 15th century, a Florentine named Marsilio Ficino, began a commentary on the nature of things, but he saw where it was going, and he burned the commentary. He burned the commentary before, as it were, it burned him. And in the early decades of the return of this remarkable work, people got, on the whole, that it was very dangerous to get too close to these ideas as your own ideas. You could get close to them as a scholar, or you could get close to them as an artist. And one of the fascinating things about this reception of Lucretius, one for me of the thrilling things about the reception, is that the first people to get fully what is at stake here are not the philosophers and not the theologians, not the intellectuals, not the university people. It's someone like Botticelli in the Primavera or the Birth of Venus. It's someone like Montaigne, the great late 16th century essayist. It's people who feel, as artists as well as intellectuals, that they something extraordinary has happened.
Well, Montaigne was greatly influenced.
Montaigne was hugely influenced. And in fact, amazingly enough,
About Montaigne.
Montaigne quotes Lucretius more than 100 times in his work. So we know that Montaigne was fascinated by and seems to have possessed something like all 7,400 lines of this very long, difficult poem in his head. Montaigne had great, great Latin. So first of all, he got it immediately as a great poem. But also, by a kind of wild circumstance, accident, in the late 20th century, a librarian at Eton College in England found in a book sale for very little money an old copy of a 16th century version of Lucretius in Latin, and he bought it. It was covered with marginalia, and he realized that it's Montaigne's marginalia. It's Montaigne's copy, covered with notes by Montaigne. He read it with a kind of passionate attention and excitement that is reflected in his work. Work that, after all, is very much about the fact that humans are not the center of the universe, that there's a much bigger world, that we're related to animals in a different way than we have arrogantly thought that we
are. And this
are.
Was Montaigne.
And this was Montaigne.
Yeah. So the center of his philosophy.
And very much the center of his philosophy, a sense of what it is to be a material being in a material world.
What about Charles Darwin?
Well, Darwin comes much, much later, of course, in the 19th century. And Darwin, though we can see that much of Darwin's principle of natural selection is anticipated as a concept in Lucretius, it's very important to realize that with Darwin, as for that matter with Einstein, there's no direct passage from one to the other. And the reason there's no direct passage is in the case of both Darwin and Einstein, there is experimental science, as well as in the case of Einstein, a form of higher mathematics, that are not available and not part of the world that's produced Lucretius. Lucretius is producing his work by extraordinary acts of human intelligence speculating about this initial idea, this pure speculation that it's atoms and emptiness and nothing else, and thinking what follows from that. In the case of Darwin, you have the Voyage of the Beagle. You have a huge year-after-year project of observing the world and taking notes and then thinking about it. But actually, Darwin's grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, was hugely influenced by Lucretius. Darwin himself was certainly aware of Lucretius's poem, but it wouldn't have been possible in the 19th century to relaunch the ideas of Lucretius, simply on the strength of saying this is an interesting philosophical idea, it needed experimental proof.
And it was getting this in this period.
It was what Darwin actually managed to bring back to the world through geology and through biology.
Karl Marx?
Marx wrote his doctoral dissertation on Democritus, that is to say, on the traces. There are, as I say, only a few quotations left from Democritus, but basically Marx relied on Lucretius's On the Nature of Things and some other quotations in random places from Democritus in order to try to understand what a materialist universe would be like, what a universe without mysterious transcendental forces would be like. So there is a very profound influence of this tradition on Karl Marx.
Thomas Jefferson.
They're strange bedfellows, aren't they, Marx and Jefferson? Jefferson had wonderful Latin. He had a superb education, and he knew Latin well. He owned 5 copies of Lucretius's poem in Latin. He didn't have to rely on it in English. There were English translations at that point, but he didn't need them. He was a great student of a French, early 17th century French philosopher named Gassendi, who attempted to reconcile Epicureanism with a kind of deistic version of Christianity. And Jefferson did something very peculiar. The Declaration of Independence was originally a document that spoke of our country as enabling life, liberty, and property. And there was a debate about it, and Jefferson decided to change the phrase, as you know, to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Think what's at stake in changing it from property to the pursuit of happiness. And what's at stake is an infusion of this idea of happiness or pleasure as the highest goal of existence of an organized state.
So we get back to Epicurus.
Well, we do. Epicurus didn't think the state could do it for you. That is to say, didn't think that society could be organized for this. And you can see why. Epicurus is living at a time in which he says, look, what you should do is not pursue the glory of Athens. Lucretius, likewise, not pursue the glory of Rome. You should withdraw to your philosophical garden with other men and women who are enlightened and speak about the nature of the good life. But Jefferson, to my deep satisfaction, was part of a generation, he wasn't alone, that believed that you could organize a whole society to enable you to pursue happiness, to enable its citizens to pursue happiness.
Again, we are speaking to Stephen Greenblatt. He is the author of the new book, The Swerve: How the World Became Modern. He is also the general editor of the Norton Shakespeare, author of the book, Will in the World: How Shakespeare Became Shakespeare. Shakespeare has been your thing for a long time. Any influence on Shakespeare in this?
Indirect influence, I think there is. Whether Shakespeare knew this poem, On the Nature of Things, is not clear. It happens that Shakespeare's friend and contemporary Ben Jonson had very good Latin, and his copy, Ben Jonson's copy of Lucretius, is in the Harvard University Library, and I've seen it and I've held it in my hand. Jonson might have been drunk when he read it because he spilled a lot of ink on it and made various other damages.
Wasn't the most well-kept person anyways, right?
No, in general, it was a mess.
Yeah.
But Shakespeare could certainly have encountered Lucretius through Jonson, or he could have encountered Lucretius through the remarkable naturalized Italian John Florio, who was someone that Shakespeare almost certainly knew. In any case, what you have as evidence is a peculiar form of evidence for Shakespeare's encounter, which is that in Romeo and Juliet, which was written in the 1590s, Mercutio makes a very strange and wonderful mad speech about Queen Mab, the principle of fantasy, or of dreams, who is a tiny, tiny creature drawn in a chariot, he says, by little atomies. Now, atomies is a very strange term to use. It's the Greek term. It's not the term that Lucretius himself used, but it's from this philosophy. And what's interesting to me about that is that Shakespeare thought he could get a laugh in the 50 90s from a popular audience that consists of both very learned and totally unlearned people, illiterate people, from the word atoms. Isn't that strange?
Yeah.
That he thought the word was enough out there so that he could get a laugh from it. And not only that, but the source for Romeo and Juliet, or multiple sources, are full of anticipations of a life that that Romeo and Juliet might have in the afterlife, after death. But in the case of Shakespeare's play, Shakespeare basically strips the story of Romeo and Juliet of that anticipation of an afterlife and thinks about the here and now, what they could get right now in this life. And when they're dead, they're going to be dead in that tomb together as corpses in the grave, not as souls in the Elysian fields.
As we move to wrap up, again, it's interesting to see the cycles. What we see with Epicurus in the Greek world, then Lucretius in the Roman world, then the influence of that on the Renaissance, a time that you specialize in. When did the Renaissance come to an end, or has it come to an end? And what do you think historians 500 years from now will look at this period where we are now?
Well, I think one thing that's fascinating, Mitch, is that if you actually think of the principles that are in Lucretius, atoms and the void and nothing else, the universe with no creator or designer, everything coming into existence randomly, no providential design, a universe that's not created all for humans and about humans, no afterlife, religions are delusions, usually cruel, no candidate for the president of the United States, Democrat or Republican, could actually run on that platform.
Yeah.
And indeed, several of our current candidates, several of whom may actually have a shot at the highest office in our country in this year, 2011, are proposing that we introduce the study of intelligent design as a theory in the classroom along with evolution. What does that mean? 2,000 years after this school of philosophy blew intelligent design out of the water as a scientific possibility. It means that we're by no means all the way there, that it's still actually in our early 21st century world where we actually count on gene splicing, MRIs, lots of things that depend on these assumptions about the universe. We're still surrounded by people who refuse to believe in them. That's strange, isn't it?
Is this a battle of ideas, do you think? Memes?
It's a battle of ideas, a battle of visions of the universe, a battle, I say, a battle of fear against the possibility of accepting the way we are in the world that we live in now. But that's, of course, my view. There are lots of people who think otherwise.
I think a lot of people have this notion that though not perfect now, we're always advancing. Is that a guarantee when you look at history?
Well, we certainly...
You had the fall of the Roman Empire, and then you had the Dark Ages.
We certainly don't advance in any straight line, that is for sure. And in my own lifetime, things that I thought were going to happen, things that I thought were inevitably going to happen. In my youth, I thought there was a historical inevitability.
Yeah.
Things are certainly not inevitable. I get that. They're not inevitable in the short term, and they're probably not inevitable in the long term either. I still hold on, Mitch, to the idea that in the very long run, the human intelligence, which is a considerable and impressive phenomenon, may actually lead us, not forever, but for a while at least, to more and more remarkable acts of understanding the way things are. So in that sense, I embrace this 2,000-year-old poem and its sense of wonder at the fact that we exist at all and at the fact that the human mind can understand things about the universe. And I'm, in that sense, guardedly hopeful.
Well, let's hope we don't lose it again.
Me too.
Stephen Greenblatt, thank you.
Thank you, Mitch.
Again, Stephen Greenblatt has been our guest. He is the author of the new book, The Swerve, How the World Became Modern.